From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farming Country. I'm your host, Kimberly Izar. Happy Saturday. It is May 9th. Well, this morning, we are so excited because we are premiering a new podcast here on Radio Catskill. It's called Ganja Granny, and it's all about cannabis for older adults. Who grows the plant, and where does it go? Julia Kim shares what's in the latest farm bill that was approved by the House and what's not in there. A new novel explores a series of suspicious fires at an abandoned resort hotel in the Adirondacks. Ronald Kelson has more. Plus, Garden Lovers Unite. Rosie Starr gives us a sneak peek into Damascus's upcoming plant swap. All of that and Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report. But first, news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Treasury Department has announced a new round of sanctions that target individuals and companies, many in China and Hong Kong. NPR's Jennifer Pack reports they're accused of helping Iran develop drones and ballistic missiles as part of its weapons program.
The U.S. Treasury accuses one Chinese individual and seven companies from China and Hong Kong of helping Iran to secure weapons and supplies for its drones and missiles. This comes days before President Trump plans to meet his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in Beijing. The leaders have a lot to discuss, but the Iran war might overshadow the meeting. China buys most of Iran's oil. The U.S. is trying to sever this economic lifeline for Iran. It has also sanctioned small private refineries in China that purchase Iranian oil. But Beijing has ordered its companies to disregard those U.S. sanctions. Jennifer Pak, NPR News, Shanghai.
Time is running out for registering to vote in this year's primary elections in some states. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports these states are getting ready to hold their contests next month.
Eligible voters in South Carolina who want to cast ballots in the state's June 9th primary have until Sunday to register online and Monday to get mail-in applications postmarked. New Jersey's voter registration deadline is Tuesday. And in Nevada, eligible voters have until Tuesday to register by mail. Online and in-person registration in Nevada continues through June 9th, which is also the day of that state's primary. If you're planning to register by mail, the U.S. Postal Service recommends stopping by a post office and asking for a free manual postmark at the counter. And if you've already registered to vote, you may want to go to your state election official's website and check your status. Eligible voters can sometimes be removed from lists, especially if they move, change their name, or haven't voted in a while. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News.
A hantavirus-stricken cruise ship is heading toward the Canary Islands and is expected to dock on Sunday. The remaining passengers will disembark and return to their home countries for monitoring. The 19 Americans on board will be taken to the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Dr. John Lowe is the director of the Global Center for Health Security at the university.
What we've been called on to do is to support the U.S., in bringing back a group of American citizens back to the U.S. safely and to ensure that they're safely monitored.
Health officials stress the hantavirus outbreak is not another COVID situation, adding that transmission generally requires prolonged close contact. The CDC is now classifying the outbreak as a level 3 emergency response. It's the lowest emergency activation tier, but still significant enough to trigger international coordination. This is NPR News.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Kimberly Izar. Crystal Run Healthcare in Rock Hill will be closing its OBGYN practice starting July 1st, leaving fewer options for women's healthcare in Sullivan County. New York Assemblymember Paula Kay says she was shocked when she started receiving phone calls from patients with the news.
It's devastating. It's absolutely devastating. Even with Crystal Run, where they are in Rock Hill, we know that the practice has dwindled over the years. So we need to do better, and I'm actively working to speak with other healthcare providers to address our crisis of women's health.
One of Crystal Run's providers will move to Sun River Health, the other to Garnet Health, and the remaining two providers will be relocated to Crystal Run's Middletown campus. Dr. Petrina Philip King, Sun River Health's OBGYN provider, says the closure reflects an alarming trend of rural healthcare cuts across upstate New York that could put patients' lives at risk.
Imagine that you have a high-risk pregnancy and you have to travel out of county at least 45 minutes an hour to your nearest labor and delivery in the middle of an acute situation. You're risking not only the survival of mom, there's risking survival of baby as well.
Crystal Run Healthcare was acquired by Optum Health in 2023. A spokesperson from Crystal Run said that the closure was about, quote, integrated care, end quote. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Farming Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. The House passed the Farm Bill last Thursday. It's a sweeping piece of federal legislation that pretty much lays out how farming, agriculture, and food nutrition operates in the United States. But farmers have been waiting for nearly 3 years for a new Farm Bill. Now the bill heads to the Senate, but small local farmers in the region say the new Farm Bill leaves them and their communities out. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim has more.
We don't need a perfect bill, right? There's nothing that's perfect. But we need one that actually keeps farmers on the land and people fed. And that means investing in the farmers and the farmland, and also investing in the communities and investing in people.
That was C. Matias. They are the founder of Sierra Vida Farm, located in Delaware County, which is a queer and BIPOC-led farm that aims to grow fresh, affordable, and culturally relevant produce for residents of Delaware County, as well as those in the Bronx. Matias started their farm 2 years ago with the mission of increasing food access through mutual aid amid one of the most precarious times for farmers in the country. In the past year alone, we've witnessed the USDA's cancellations to land access contracts and programs, steep cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, otherwise known as SNAP, climate change-induced crop damage, increasing industry consolidation, and more. For Finca Seremos in Sullivan County, which is a local farm that supplies food for communities in Upper Manhattan and the Bronx, co-founder Chris Nickel explained that the cuts to SNAP also threaten a significant part of their revenue. Currently, 25% of their CSA members are SNAP recipients, and food assistance programs like SNAP have made up around 20% of their revenue since they founded the farm back in 2022.
CSA is often thought to be a more middle-class, upper-middle-class access point for produce, and we're trying to flip that on its head, because we think everybody deserves access to nutrient-dense, locally grown, organically grown produce. And one of the ways that we do that is through focusing on our SNAP members, who pay half price for a share, and a nutrition incentive program from the feds that thankfully was not cut yet, and administered by the Glenwood Center for Regional Food and Farming called CSA is a SNAP. That program gives us the remaining half of that share's value. So we as the farmers take home a full share's value, and our members who use SNAP only have to pay half of that with their EBT card.
Some proponents, however, do see the Farm Bill as taking a step forward. For example, it established a new permanent program known as Local Farmers Feeding Our Communities following last year's termination of the popular local food purchase assistance and local food for schools programs, which in New York is referred to as New York Food for New York Families, or NFNF. These two programs had allowed large-scale buyers like schools and food pantries to buy directly from local farmers and helped increase the resiliency of the regional food supply chain. It comes amid other calls to expand regional food business centers and establish an office of small farms in the USDA to further support small and mid-sized farmers and further the regionalization of food production. When the original two programs still existed, Matias described how
so many of mutual aid organizations, so many food pantry organizations, they were able to freely have a good amount of buying power to stretch their capacity and feed more people. We were feeding 150 to 250 people a week, like a full CSA share boxes. We were able to feed people a week, and it created this momentum where people kept coming back and saying what they liked and like really felt held by the communities who were distributing this food, but also allowed these organizations more capacity to buy a diverse amount of food, like more fruit, more tomatoes, like more greens that were culturally relevant. And they were able to pay us farmers like good value so that we can keep doing this mutual aid work. It was just like, wow, I didn't know someone would be able to pay for my vegetables at this price, that I'm able to do more.
For Nickel, the $25,000 in funding from NFNF had been vital in bridging the gap in access to culturally relevant food for communities of color throughout New York. At the time that they didn't have enough CSA members to match their produce, Finca Seremos turned to working with local food pantries like Fairground and Beacon and New York Common Pantry in the Bronx, earning around 25% of the revenue through these partnerships.
We moved lemongrass to a Southeast Asian community that Fairground serves in Poughkeepsie at the Rip Van Winkle houses. Similarly, collards to the African American community and the Afro-diaspora communities in and around Beacon. We heard from them how impactful it was to be able to have this kind of access. Tomatillos for our folks in the city, for Central American communities especially. So that's the sort of impact for our farm. For the ecosystem of the sort of regionalizing of the food shed in New York, NFNF allowed us, again, all of our farms to build these relationships directly with mutual aid and pantry organizations and begin to develop logistics through which we could move food at scale to them wherever they may be.
Those relationships Finca Seremos forged were then put abruptly on pause with the cancellation of those two programs, posing further complications in terms of crop planning and distribution. Sierra Vida is placed on the West Branch Commons, a community land trust in the Catskills dedicated to ensuring continuous access to affordable farming land for queer and BIPOC farmers. Originally the land of fourth-generation dairy farmer Tommy Hudson, Matias said they carry this legacy in fighting to make sure farmers secure the funding they need to maintain their land.
Removing funds from EQIP, which provides high tunnels, drip irrigation, erosion control, buffer plantings, things that keep the land from, you know, the nutrients leaching out into the water, keeps the land held, you know, keeps the waterways clear and healthy. And, you know, a part of the West Branch Commons and the ways that we're shaping our responsibility as just as an organization and also as farmers is like we have a responsibility to be the future elders like Tom to be able to pay that forward and continue to take care of the land. If funding like this is being removed from beginning farmers like myself, like, yes, we have the land, we're on the land, but not being able to have, you know, capital funds and government support, you know, to be able to upstart our operations, what can we actually financially do to be able to keep this legacy going in protecting the land and the watershed?
Nickel said the farm bill as it stands fails to meet the needs of both local farms like theirs and the diversity of communities that they aim to serve, and cannot move forward before these major issues are addressed.
It's all getting us further and further away from the kind of food system that actually meets people's needs. And so I don't have any illusions that we're going to see a revolutionary farm bill this time around, given the current political circumstances. But I do think it's important that we push back in a really full-throated way against this continued corporate consolidation of an agriculture system that on the face of it is actually supposed to be about getting people good food, but hasn't been about that for a very long time.
While the farm bill did pass in the House, its future in the Senate is much more precarious, as the cuts to SNAP still remain a fierce point of contention. I'm Julie Kim for Radio Catskill.
Thanks to Julia for that report. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, Ganja Granny makes her debut.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's an Italian feast with chef, cookbook author, and bean master Hilary Sterling of Ci Siamo in New York City. And after dinner, let's have a sweet bite with Domenica Marchetti, author of the book Italian Cookies. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
On This Old House Radio Hour, learn how to grow the best tomatoes, even if you only have space for a bucket.
You only need a 10-gallon can, and you can have that sitting on your back porch. Very simple.
Plus, comedian Tom Papa takes us inside his Jersey Shore beach house. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour.
Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, this morning, I and, you know, really the whole Radio Catskill team, we are so excited because we are going to be premiering a new podcast called Ganja Granny. It's hosted by longtime former NPR cultural correspondent Karen Michelle. And it's all about what older folks need or want to know about cannabis. Who grows the plant? How strains are different from one another, and what could possibly work for you. I was really quite, you know, honestly surprised to learn that older adults are the fastest growing population of cannabis users. So I'm excited that we get to share this information with y'all. Here is the debut episode of Ganja Granny with host Karen Michelle.
Hey, I'm Karen Michelle. Welcome to my new podcast, Ganja Granny, where we'll be checking into all things ganja, cannabis, especially as it relates to the older folks among us. On this, the first episode, we will visit several dispensaries in New York to find out what it's like to be inside, what to expect, and what you may want to think about before you go. In future shows, we'll get into what those hundreds of strains are, the various categories and ways to consume, and especially the effects on folks over 50. Let's begin at the beginning, for without the plant, there'd be no dispensaries.
My name is Stacy Shergan, and we are in Ankrum, New York, at our greenhouse, which cultivates cannabis. I and my very dear friend slash almost brother, Benjamin Weiner.
Stacy's in her 50s, Ben's in his 60s. He's the head cultivator and co-owner of Hudson Valley Jane, their brand. He'd been busted for cannabis years back, though not convicted. Stacy's experience differs.
I smoked a little pot in high school, but barely. And I also was an older parent who realized that using low-dose edibles could really help me stay married and not strangle my children. So when Ben brought me this idea, I said, that sounds cool. Okay, let's see.
Now you're coming into the greenhouse where we have all our plants. We grow in a gutter-connected greenhouse in our maximum allowed capacity, which is 5,000 square feet. And the way we do it is we have 5 bays here of flowering. This bay may be at 0 weeks, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks harvest. So in other words, every 2 weeks, we're getting a fresh harvest. So the plants that you're looking at right now, right here, are Banana OG, which you can certainly touch it and smell it if you want.
Of course I did. The buds, the part of the plant you'd be smoking, were kind of hard, a bit springy, and mighty sticky. Stacy and I, we were both licking our fingers.
This next grouping here is Fantasy, which is a lot of people's favorite.
And after harvesting, curing, trimming, and packaging, these plants will be transformed into much of what's on the shelves at Hudson Valley Jane's only dispensary, an hour's drive away in Beacon, New York.
Hi, Ganja Granny. How are you doing today? Good to see you back in the store.
Ryan Paul is the manager. He used to work in the greenhouse.
Once you actually see one of these beauties up close and personal, you really get to see how magical of a plant it is. I remember the first time I saw one, I thought it came from outer space, just the way it looks. Like, it doesn't look like any other plant on this planet.
Are you looking for anything in specific today? You feeling like you need a little energy? Maybe something to go to sleep?
Yeah, maybe both. My salt and pepper hair isn't out of place.
I mean, I love going weed shopping with my mom. I mean, like, yeah, my mom's smokes more weed than I do, probably, to be honest.
Over here, these are going to be our pre-rolls.
The place is inviting. Kind of farmhousey, with a comfy chair in a corner, and a sofa and hay bales in the back room, where there'll be stoner movie nights. Older customers are the largest growing segment of consumers in the cannabis market, just ask AARP. Some are first-timers, others committed stoners, and most have a reason they're buying. Ryan knows there are limitations to the advice he can give them.
From a compliance standpoint, you're not allowed to give medical advice in a recreational cannabis dispensary. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a pharmacist. I don't have that background. You know, I've been selling weed since I was 15, so I know a lot about the benefits, health benefits the plant can give you. But, you know, if you've got, you know, pre-existing medical conditions, I don't know about those. I'm not your doctor. Like, we just want to keep everybody safe at the end of the day.
That's where people like Dr. Kenneth Weinberg come in. He founded Cannabis Doctors of New York nearly a decade ago.
I see a lot of elderly people who, you know, grew up with reefer madness. And the first thing they say to me, you know, they've been convinced because so many of them have tried so many other things and none of it works. And they or their family or friends say, try cannabis. It worked for me.
Some call him Dr. Cannabis. He specializes in advising older folks.
But the first thing they say is, okay, I'm interested, but I want to make sure I don't get high.
How about the ones who say the opposite?
Mazel tov.
In a future Ganja Granny show, we'll visit medical marijuana dispensaries, get into the rules and regs for getting and staying certified, and the advantages and not of doing so, and spend more time with Dr. Ken, Dr. Cannabis, and Dr. Brian Caskey of the University of Iowa, and others who studied ganja and its relationship with the very many of us over 50. Luna May is in her 60s. She lives in New York's Hudson Valley.
So when you go into a dispensary, what do you look for?
Oh, well, first of all, where the dispensary is at, the location. I look for how the people treat me when I walk in. I also look for to see what type of knowledge they have, because when I go in the front door, the first thing I ask, I say, you smoke?
Sarah's in her 70s and lives in Los Angeles.
Clean. And I want to know that they're buying clean product, not dirty schmutz from off the streets.
How do you know those things?
It's a bit of a matter of faith.
Kirill is also in her 70s and lives in the Midwest. She wants...
playful. And the playful was really important.
At a new dispensary in Fishkill, about a 15-minute drive away from Hudson Valley Jane, there's a very pink wallpaper mural of a giant astronaut floating among bright green marijuana leaves. Tyler manages the place.
So Just Little Higher is the name of the dispensary. The location is Fishkill, 982 Main Street.
You're in a mall.
Yeah, we're in a plaza right next to the UPS. Well, I do want to be the Apple Store of weed.
The place is large and filled with display cases around the sides and in the middle. It feels like the jewelry section of a department store, but instead of rings and watches, the cases are filled with all manner brand and packaging of cannabis. They're edibles, tinctures, flower, pre-rolls, joints, vaporizers, drinks, and tins and boxes and pouches, both rectangular and unusually shaped. One looks like a gas pump, another lips.
Well, I do want to be the apple store of weed. I want to basically be what you know to, like, come here and learn, not just pick up your weed, not just be, like, you're not just a transaction. Like, literally, we're a family. Like, granted, it's 7 stores. We still want to be considered mom and pop because we're still so small. It's still, like, family ran. It's a family member at every store. Once you be comfortable, like, you come to your grandma's house on Thanksgiving, regular, opening the fridge, because who wouldn't want to be comfortable with the weed man? Like, the weed girl, I should say.
Many of the customers are that grandma. Some of them after a workout at the gym, some first-timers.
It doesn't matter if you've been smoking for 50 years or 5 minutes. Like, we're going to answer it. We're going to walk you through it. We're going to be there for you. If it's nasty, we're going to try again. We're going to find it. We're going to get it together.
She figures she's tried everything in the store and knows how it works for her. But she's in her 30s. She knows it's different for everybody, especially if, like me, you're a multiple of 30. No matter your age, you'll be carded sooner or later, either by a serious guy, it's usually a guy just inside the front door, or at checkout. At many dispensaries, the carding comes when you're buying, not before, as you'd expect. It affects the vibe.
Hi, my name is Anne. I'm 77, and I've been smoking dope, since I'm 16.
Okay, you know you want to get something.
Right.
So you go, and let's say you want to go to a new place or you're in a new neighborhood or whatever, and you're walking by. What attracts you to even go in?
Okay. It shouldn't look empty and dead. It should have softer edges a little bit. It shouldn't look like a drugstore. It should look like a pleasant shopping place. Doesn't have to have couches or anything like that, but it shouldn't look like you're going to Walmart. I don't know. More boutique-y, I guess.
Hi! Are you Karen?
No, I am.
The greenhouse dispensary is in the Catskills in a green Victorian house along a short main street in Jeffersonville, a village with fewer than 1,000 year-round residents. Walmart, it isn't.
So I've got a house plant 70s hippie marijuana vibe going in here. And it's also just a reminder that that marijuana is a plant.
Lauren Cycley and her husband own the place. It's one of several businesses they have. There's also a liquor store and a pastry shop. Though she'd done some consuming when she was younger, it wasn't until some years ago that Lauren came back to cannabis because of illness.
I myself went through chemo and needed to eat and needed to keep my body strong. And this was what I used to help me through it. And so if I can share an anecdotal story, or Aaron shares an anecdotal story to try to help people, we do.
Aaron is one of the butt tenders.
Let's just keep it at Aaron.
He's got a salt and pepper man bun, grizzled beard, and long experience in the cannabis industry. Ketzel, who's in her 60s, is a frequent customer. As it is in most dispensaries, she brought cash. Unlike most, the prices shown in products here include the tax.
As an adult, I know how I want to be after smoking weed for so long. And he makes the difference.
That one, and then you have, I think, $33 more after that.
The job of the bud tender, despite the name, isn't to mix different cannabis flowers together to come up with a cocktail. Sometimes bud tenders stay behind the counter, other times they roam the floor. Sometimes they offer and give advice, other times they figure the customer knows what they want, and ultimately the bud tender takes your order.
I don't have an eighth over $40.
An eighth is 3.5 grams an eighth of an ounce and is the standard packaging for ganja, as are single grams and up to whole ounces. Prices vary.
We had an eighth that we had to charge $55 for, and it killed me. It killed me. It killed my soul, because I knew that 15 of that went into embossed packaging with 15 different colors that was holding a glass jar inside that was covered in black.
Ah, shiny.
His advice?
Buy small amounts, don't buy big amounts, just in case it didn't work for you. My godfather, who was also my pediatrician growing up, he's a cannabis proponent. And I asked him when I first started in sales, was how do I differentiate? How do I tell someone about the cannabinoid system, endocannabinoid system? And he goes, it is more personal to you than anything on your body. He's like, if there was a full-on database of everyone's thumbprint in the world, you probably have the same one as somebody else. Your endocannabinoid system, zero chance.
Think endocrine system, but more so. And more on that in the next Ganja Granny. Aaron and I may both be experienced, but unlike his godfather, neither of us is a medical professional. As in everything, yes, everything you put into your body, the mantra, the maxim, the must-do is... start low, go slow. Pay attention. The Greenhouse, just a little higher, and Hudson Valley Jane are all on Main Street, an actual one.
We specialize in farm to Main Street cannabis.
Ryan from Hudson Valley Jane.
So it's kind of like farm to table for the Hudson Valley.
And just as it's come to Main Street, ganja has also become increasingly mainstream. I look forward to sharing another session with you and your friends, so tell them to give a listen as we explore the chemistry of ganja in the body, especially for older folks. The sativa indica debate, the hundreds of strains, what are they and what are they good for, and the various ways to consume, among many other topics. Some of them to be determined by you, the listeners. We'll be on this journey together. Ganja Granny is co-produced and distributed in partnership with Radio Catskill. Bless them. If you believe in what we're doing and want to help keep it going and growing, sponsoring this podcast is a way to do it. Please contact ganjagrannypodcast at gmail.com. That's GANJAGRANNY podcast at gmail.com. You got questions? Send them in. Piece of sound art that encapsulates your experience with ganja? Yes, please. Thanks to mix engineer Scott Mueller, editor Tom Cole, Ben Neal, inventor of the mutant trumpet, for his original music, Ron English for additional music, and Michael D'Antuono for the logo. This program was produced and written by me, Karen Michelle.
And that was the debut episode of Karen Michelle's Ganja Granny. We're going to be rolling out new episodes here on Farm and Country when those are available. But you can, you know, re-listen to the episode you just heard. You can share it with your community. You can find it on our website at wjffradio.org under the shows tab, under podcasts, and you'll see Ganja Granny right there. Up next, you know what time it is, this week's Star Talk Report from Keith Hubbard.
Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. NASA's Curiosity rover has been exploring Mars since 2012. Since that time, the SUV-sized rover has traveled 22 miles in its quest to determine if Mars was ever able to support microbial life. Along the way, it has found evidence that Mars once had lakes and streams, that biologically and chemically usable nitrogen was present on Mars, and it has detected organic molecules in rocks on the red planet. New research published last month reveals that Curiosity has discovered the most diverse set of organic molecules ever found on Mars. Curiosity drilled into a rock and pulverized the sample into powder. Then it fed the sample into an instrument called the Sample Analysis at Mars, or SAM, where it was analyzed. SAM identified 21 organic molecules in the sample, 7 of which were detected for the first time on Mars. Though the sample was analyzed in 2020, the results were not published until last month. Scientists validated the results of SAM by using the same technique on a meteorite that contains organic compounds. These findings do not confirm that Mars once supported life. The organic molecules found can be created by biologic and geologic processes. What the findings do support is that Mars once had the right chemistry to support life. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future StarTalk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and StarTalk, this has been Keith Hubbard reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks so much to Keith for that report. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, garden lovers in Damascus prepare for an upcoming plant swap. That's up next.
This is Radio Catskill, keeping Pennsylvania voters connected. Pennsylvania's primary election is May 19th. Polls will be open 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. The last day to apply for a mail-in or absentee ballot is May 12th, and it must be received by your county election office by 8 p.m. on May 19th. A postmark by that time is not sufficient. More info is at vote.pa.gov. This is Radio Catskill, keeping Pennsylvania voters connected.
Last week on Wait, Wait, legendary anchorman Ron Burgundy reminisced about good times with our legendary anchorman, Bill Curtis.
Bill and I, Walter Cronkite, Angie Dickinson, and a flamethrower down at the dog track in Tijuana.
Oh, wow. I'm Peter Sagal. We'll find out what Mischief composer and EGOT winner Bobby Lopez got up to with Bill when he joins us for this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Farm and Country here on Radio Catskill. The Damascus Township will host its third annual community plant swap next Saturday, May 16th. Rosie Starr caught up with the gardeners and event organizers about the seeds, the tools, and the tips that attendees can swap. Here's more.
For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr. I'm over at the Damascus Manor Community Center. We've just had another wonderful potluck. And the room that we have our meetings in once a month, or all the meetings that take place at the Damascus Manor Community Center, has a facelift, new paint, beautiful. I'm standing now with two ladies that are very active in this organization. It's springtime, and they work in the garden. They work with their hands in the garden, very talented in the community. I will let them introduce themselves and say what's coming up, and there's lots happening.
Hello, I'm Joyce Castleberry, and I am a master gardener in Pennsylvania. We are going to have a plant swap at the pavilion at the Damascus Manor Community Center on May 16th. 10 a.m. to 1:30 p.m., and we hope you will come, and we hope that you will bring plants that you have left over from your own garden preparations, perennials that you've split that you may have extras of, or, you know, that little seedling group of six and you only need five, that extra one, we have a place for it. We have a lot going on here, and we hope you'll come on May 16th, 10 a.m. to 1:30 p.m.
I have been here in the past, and I noticed that there were lots of fruit trees. Now, is this just dependent on what neighbors want to bring what item?
We hope to have those again this year. It has not been confirmed.
But you never know what you're going to find. Always, there's always some gem that you're going to find, some beauty. My name's Irene Soloway. I'm also a master gardener in Wayne County, and Joyce and I have been volunteering at the county jail, working with inmates on teaching gardening skills and actually creating a garden together. This is the third year of the garden, and the garden got started out of the plant swap 3 years ago, donations from the community, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, things that inmates can plant and enjoy, and we're looking for donations, and that would be really wonderful. If you come to the plant swap and you have something that you think would be appropriate for that garden, please bring it. We'll set it aside.
When you say community correction facility, you're saying Wayne County?
Wayne County.
It's the jail in Honesdale.
Tell us a little bit about that program.
Well, it's been an ongoing program that was interrupted for many years as a result of COVID. And 3 years ago, Irene and I were looking for a way to do our Master Gardener contributions of time. And Irene called the jail and said, possibly would you be able to use a garden at the jail? And they said, can you start tomorrow? So we said, yes. And it's just been going very, very smoothly since then. They are just so lovely to work with.
And the jail is appreciated by everyone from the warden, the correction officers, the inmates, everybody who works there, and the inmates, the volunteers. Everybody talks about the garden, and it's so much a part of enhancing the experience of all of us.
How is it benefiting both the community inside the correctional facility and Wayne County?
Well, the people who are inside the correctional facilities are actually our neighbors. And a lot of them are inspired to start their own gardens or learning skills that they can take on the outside to help other people with their gardens. And it's both educational and part of a rehabilitation process. So it benefits the entire community.
Not the least of which are these two people that are there. Irene and I feel like we get more out of it than anyone.
Yeah.
And talk about that experience. What is that like?
Oh, just to see someone who may have made a bad decision or two in their lives just sink their hand into the earth, plant a little bitty seedling, pat it into place, and look at it lovingly. I mean, it just warms the cockles of your heart. You just want to say yes. And that seedling, I will tell you, will grow beautifully.
There's a lot of good vibes that go into that. Let's go back to the plant swap here at the Damascus Manor Community Center. Are there things that you won't accept at the plant swap?
Master Gardeners will be at the plant swap, so we can kind of keep an eye on, you know, if there's something very invasive that we understand could harm people's gardens, we would, you know, talk about that. If somebody has a question about that, that would be under discussion.
You know, there's lots of things that people need to learn. I mean, we have had people show up with poison ivy. So just start from there.
And not weed. So that's an NOT.
Would you accept tools or equipment?
Oh, yes, tools, books.
Yeah. Anything related to what somebody could use in the garden or to learn about gardening would be accepted. And if somebody wants to just come and for the community of being in a gardening community and quite with questions or just wanting to commune, that's great too.
I would think this is rain or shine.
It's a covered facility with plenty of parking, so we are rain or shine, yes.
There's also a really wonderful playground behind the pavilion, so people with kids can come and the kids would play in the playground and the adults could play in the with the plants.
I know we're by the Coshecton Bridge.
Yeah, it's Conklin Hill Road. If you come from the bridge, it's a right on Conklin Hill Road, and you just go up and you follow the signs.
We will have plant swap signs out, particularly as you get close to it, because it does wind a little bit. It'll be easy to find, but it is on Conklin Hill Road.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we close?
Come and enjoy it. Be prepared to have a good time.
Yeah.
May 16th, 10 a.m. to 1:30 p.m.
And we look forward to seeing you there.
Thank you.
The location for the Damascus County Community Center is 60 Conklin Hill Road in Wayne County, Pennsylvania. The DMCC hosts a variety of events, classes, potlucks, and is the site for the recycling center. More information is available on their website, pa-dmcc.org. That's pa-dmcc.org. For Radio Catskill and Farm and Country, this is Rosie Starr.
Thanks to Rosie for that conversation. That plant swap is going to be next Saturday, May 16, at the Damascus Township Pavilion. Christopher Melly, a 40-year news reporter and editor who lives in Pike County, has penned a second mystery novel set in the Adirondacks, which was inspired by true life events. The novel, The Truth is in the Ashes, follows the story of a journalist, solving a series of suspicious fires at an abandoned hotel. Radio Catskill's Ronald Kelson spoke with Christopher Melly about the inspiration behind the novel.
Tell us a little bit about your background. You've obviously had a long career before you started writing novels, but tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been up to in your life.
Certainly. Thanks, and thanks for having me. So I've been a newsman for 40 years. I grew up in the Bronx, and I knew from a very young age I wanted to cover news, be a reporter, be in newspapers. I grew up during kind of a pretty turbulent time in the city, and the tabloids were just filled with just incredible breaking news and politics and corruption and all kinds of stuff that I found attractive and flavorful. And so I worked in the Adirondacks, and I've worked in the Hudson Valley at the Times-Herald Record for about 17, 18 years, including, in fact, I did a stint when I first joined the paper. I did a stint in the Monticello Bureau in Sullivan County. And then I worked, went from there to become executive editor of the Pocono Record in Stroudsburg. And going on 11 years ago, I joined, actually 12 years ago, I joined the New York Times, first as a copy editor, and now I'm a deputy editor on our breaking news team, which is called Express. So, you know, I never thought in my life that I was ever going to write fiction, because obviously I've had a career dedicated to the truth and details and nonfiction. And so I call myself an accidental novelist, in that my first novel, Goodwill Secrets, which was published 2 years ago, I kind of fell into it. I developed it first as a short story, actually in my head. I never even wrote the short story. And the more I built on it, the more it sort of took life. And I was like, God, could this possibly be a novel? I really was sort of incredulous. And one thing led to another. And then, you know, 2 years later, I have kind of the follow-up novel, which is The Truth is in the Ashes, which sort of picks up where the first one left off. And they're both set, they're both mysteries set in the Adirondack Mountains in New York.
You describe your work, and you hit on this a little bit before, as fictional realism. Can you describe for us what that is and, of course, how that drove you to write novels, obviously, after a career talking about, you know, factual and current events and things like that?
Sure. It's interesting. I, you know, even though I'm writing fiction, I can't get away from being grounded in fact-based reporting. So my notion, sort of my niche, if you will, of fictional realism is that my novels are as fact-based and grounded in reality as possible. That is to say, there's some novels I read that say mysteries, detective novels, police procedurals, and they take shortcuts, right? They take legal shortcuts, or they take shortcuts in investigations, or sometimes things that drive me crazy, they'll misname or mislabel police titles and things like that. And so my goal is to not have leaps of logic. That is to say, you know, things follow a certain chronology that makes sense in the real world. And I think part of the attraction for that is, you know, people who are lawyers, investigators, mystery buffs, maybe they're just, you know, detective and police buffs as well, they understand how these things work. And I think it's kind of an insult to their intelligence if I get that wrong. And so I think the other thing, too, is that the details matter, you know, not just simply what color is the character's hair, but, you know, how long before, let's say, a body decomposes, or what are the symptoms of a certain, situation? What would a detective do in these circumstances? What would the procedure be like in court, all those things? And I mean, it makes it a little bit more challenging in the sense that because I'm putting up those guardrails, I have to sort of stay in that lane. But I also think to me, it makes it more appealing. I guess the bottom line is that what I wind up writing is a book that I would want to read and that I would appreciate. And so that's sort of my goal in the back of my mind as I'm writing.
You also mentioned you, for work, moved into Pennsylvania, and I also know that you currently live in Pike County. So I just want to know, what do you like about living in Pike County?
Oh, well, let's see. We've been here, it's going on 22 years, and we had lived in Middletown. I moved here with my then fiance, and she died about 18 months after we moved here. And so I raised my two boys here and remarried. And, you know, the thing about Pike is it's just away from the hustle and bustle. I mean, we're literally in a community in the woods where I can count on one hand the number of cars that come by our street. Last night or the night before, we had the windows open and we could hear owls hooting. We've got all kinds of wildlife, you know, you name it, you know, hawks, black bears, deer, raccoons, skunks, the whole gamut. And it's just amazing. It's right at your, you know, you're literally at your front doorstep. And it's just peaceful. And I just like the sense of serenity that comes with living here. Plus, it's Milford is a quaint town. It's, you know, only maybe 25 minutes from us. And the people here are friendly. It's kind of an open community. And we're also, where we live is maybe, we're maybe like 20 minutes from the Delaware River. So, you know, all in all, it's not a bad place to live at all.
Certainly isn't. So now let's go a little bit deeper into this ongoing series of novels you have, including the new one that just came out. Tell us a little bit more about what's happening in that novel and what we can expect.
Absolutely. Well, the first novel introduced us to a newsman, a guy named Alex Proveto, who has had a career in other bigger newspapers, but now is in a smaller paper in the Adirondacks through a series of life events. And this second novel continues with Alex. It's about maybe 2 years on from the previous novel. And what he gets sort of ensnared in unwittingly is an investigation and trying to unravel what is going on with a serial arsonist who is on the prowl in the Adirondacks, in the village of Goodwill. And he, through a series of a chain of events, he winds up getting roped into it. And at first, he's perhaps like a little bit resistant, but then it's figuring out what's going on, getting to the bottom of things is sort of his catnip. It is the thing that he finds irresistible as a newsman. And then there are some personal complications that come out in the book, and it continues in the Adirondacks. And I treat the Adirondacks almost as a character unto itself because it's such a special place. It's got its own unique feel. The weather there is so changeable and unique, and the people are so down to earth, and they kind of eke out a gritty existence because it's not the most easy place to make a living. Some people are holding down two or three jobs over the course of the year just to make ends meet. So it continues that as a backdrop. And again, the Adirondacks, because I worked and lived there when I first started my career. I worked up there for 5 years. It's a special place in my heart. We enjoy going back to visit there. And this was an opportunity / an excuse for me to go to go up there and do more research. Again, kind of circling back to the fictional realism to help me get certain details and the vibe and the feel of the place just right.
I want to get a little more into the book as well. One of the inciting actions in your book is this, again, a serial arsonist setting fires at a resort, a long abandoned resort. And obviously, as you've worked in Monticello, you know our listening area here in Sullivan County is pretty famous for its history of hotels and resorts. So I just want to get into a little bit of why you chose that as an inciting action. What about a resort kind of plays into this story?
That's actually an interesting parallel that you draw, because in fact, when I first joined the Times Herald Record and the Sullivan Bureau, I was just at the very tail end of what was still the, the glory days of the Borscht Belt. I mean, it was definitely fading. I mean, Grossinger's had closed and was on the market, but Brown's was, I think, in the process of being converted into condos. I think the Ehrlichs and the Pines was still open. The Neverly, I think, was still open. So there were still the pockets of them. But the truth is, what inspired me was this grand hotel resort, which was called the Lake Placid Club, which took up like 1,100 acres, was founded in the turn of the century, like I think, well, actually 1895, that turn of the century, by Melville Dewey of the Dewey Decimal System. And this place became kind of a city unto itself. It was just sprawling with hundreds of buildings, huge guest cottages, huge hotel. They had their own fire department, for instance, and they just had luminaries that came there. It was sort of a place for, like, intellectuals together and to have lectures and things like that. Fast forward, you know, almost 100 years, the last time that the club was effectively used was during the 1980 Winter Olympics. And after that, it fell on hard times. It went through bankruptcy and then receivership. And there was a couple of false starts to regenerate it as a first-class resort. And what started to happen was in 1991, there was at least a dozen unsolved arsons targeting this club. And some of them were small, and some of them were humongous. And the one that stands out in my mind was there was a lodge which was called the Theanogan Lodge. And to call it a lodge was really a misnomer because this thing was a gargantuan building, a standalone building unto itself. And I worked like literally around the corner. My office was around the corner from the Theanogan. And at this point, we were aware that there's been these fires. I heard the fire alarms on my scanner, and I tore out of the office. And I actually got to the Theanogan, which was fully involved. I got there even before the firefighters, and this was in November, and I was so close taking photos. It was so hot and so emanating so much heat, I actually had to take off my winter coat to you know, like not, you know, not sweat myself to death. So the photos I captured were really quite amazing. And the truth is, the whole club eventually got razed, and it's, you know, now been sort of converted, but they never charged anyone. They never arrested anybody in those unexplained arsons. And that was something that just sort of stayed with me. And that was sort of the part of the seeds for The Truth is in the Ashes.
Chris, is there anything else you want to add before we sign off?
Just that if people are interested in finding out more, they can go to chrismellyauthor.com. There's more information there about myself, links where you can find my two books, which are available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and you can order them through independent booksellers. And you can also sign up for my newsletter at my website. We'd love to hear from people, you know, for them to share their thoughts about the books or just literature or whatever they're reading. I'd love to have a dialogue with readers, and really appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
My pleasure. Yeah, that's Christopher Melly, a Pike County resident right in our listening area. He's got a new book out, The Truth is in the Ashes, seconds in a series of mysteries set in the Adirondacks based on real-life events. It's available now wherever books are sold. Chris, again, thank you so much for coming on. We hope to talk to you again.
Terrific. Thank you again.
Thanks so much to Ronald for that conversation. A few happenings in our community the next few days. Today is May 9th, and you heard it here, it's planting season. The Mamikating Environmental Education Center in Wurtsboro is hosting its first native plant sale today. That's happening right now up until 2 p.m., and it will feature native plants that support pollinators and songbirds. And then on Tuesday, May 12th, the Western Sullivan Public Library will host a DIY energy saving session at the Jeffersonville branch. Steve Bonds-Lipte is an energy advisor from the Cornell Cooperative Extension. And Steve is going to share how you can take, you know, simple DIY actions to reduce energy waste and save money on your utility bills. That'll be at 6 p.m. on May 12th. More events are on our community calendar on our website at wjffradio.org. And that's all for this week's show. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team and post-production by Ronald Kelson. Stick around. Up next, it's Cats Cast with Brett Berry. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. I'll catch you next week.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
Emily Amick is a Democratic influencer, and she's been telling the party to get better at online messaging for years.
Honey, you don't understand politics. You're the comms guru of the party, and you're just learning about TikTok? That's crazy.
Meanwhile, the Republican Party has a highly sophisticated online and social media operation.
Look, who doesn't love to be right? I wish I wasn't.
That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Greetings and salutations, theater fans. It's Tom Candela from Curtain Call. This week on the show, I'm joined by Brendan Burke and Ben Williamson of Shadowland Stages for an in-depth conversation about the theater's ambitious 2026 lineup, the creative process behind building a year of plays and musicals, and just what it takes to sustain professional live theater in our community. That's Monday night at 7 here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.